getting old. Is it the golden years or something not for sissies?
The fact is that most people who die in their late 80s and 90s do not die the proverbial heart attack with no suffering preceding it while making love or skydiving or paragliding. Most people who die at those ages die after a long period of disability and suffering.
That's Susan Jacoby. We'll talk to her about her critique of the myth and marketing of the new old age. It's called Never Say Die. And our model of caring for the elderly is broken. But Dr. Alan Teal thinks he has a solution. And he's been putting it into practice in Maine.
A little bit of technology, a little bit of good old-fashioned neighborliness, a little bit of common sense, and a little bit of medical care. And can we put those ingredients together to make a far more affordable model and a far more engaging and humane model than what we have right now?
We'll talk to him about his approach and his book, Alone and Invisible No More. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's going to happen to all of us, if we're lucky. We're going to get old, and more of us will get very old. 20 years from now, some 9 million people will be over the age of 85, rising to over 20 million by 2050. We need to keep that in mind as our political leaders are deciding the fate of Medicare and Social Security. Because being very old is very difficult and very expensive. Contrary to the much-promoted image of skydiving centenarians, most of us who live into our 80s and 90s and beyond will suffer debilitation of our bodies and, many of us, our minds as well. And just because you live a healthy lifestyle doesn't mean you're going to dodge the bullet. My nearly 91-year-old mother is a case in point. Until she was 83, she was a paragon of successful old age. A pioneering modern dancer and choreographer, her last performance was at the age of 83 at Lincoln Center. She exercised daily her whole life, and she's been eating whole foods since the early 1960s. But old age caught up with my mom, and while her mind is still pretty sharp, she has trouble walking and on most days struggles for every breath. My guest Susan Jacoby knows this landscape of old age intimately. She took care of her late partner throughout his years of suffering from Alzheimer's. A social critic who spoke with us on Writer's Voice about a previous book, The Age of American Unreason, Jacoby has now turned her trenchant pen to exploding the myth of the new old age, a myth being marketed by self-help gurus and the drug companies. It's time to get realistic, Susan Jacoby says, and start preparing for the silver tsunami. Susan Jacoby, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
I am very happy to be welcome back to your great program.
Thank you. I love this book, Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. Now, you had a partner who got Alzheimer's disease, is that correct?
I did. He was 15 years older than I am, and I'm 65.
And you had to watch his deterioration and decline. In what ways did your experience with him influence the writing of this book?
Well, I started writing this book before the worst of this happened, but it influenced me in a particular way because I saw how my partner was, he had the most brilliant mind which I've ever known intimately. And I saw when he got Alzheimer's. Fortunately, mercifully, he died 3 years ago of cancer before he entered the very last stages of Alzheimer's. But I realized that I had been magic thinking. I had always sort of unconsciously told myself, although I know better because I've written a lot about science, that very intelligent people don't get Alzheimer's, that educated people don't get Alzheimer's, that this was some kind of a talisman against this, what to me is the most feared and dreaded age-related disease. And when he got it, it destroyed that kind of defense. And it made me think about, he had, in many ways, if you can be said to have an optimal situation for having Alzheimer's, he had a lot of people who loved him and cared about him. And people are able, in the middle stages of Alzheimer's, to do a lot of things if they have people to care for them. But if they don't, I can remember his turning to me on the crosstown bus one day and saying, I feel that somewhere inside me is the person I really am, the person I was before.
Right.
But I can't find him. I can't talk to him. And I thought, first of all, I understood that he understood perfectly what was happening to him and what an agony it was. And how would it be to have that happen to you if you were old enough so that there was no one left to help you?
You make a distinction between the young old age and the old age. And it's not one, it's one that is glossed over quite a bit.
Well, it's a distinction. I didn't make it. It's how sociologists and doctors classify it. The young old are considered to be people in their 60s and 70s. The old are in their 80s, 90s, and beyond. And there's a very distinct difference between those. I think those two stages have some validity, if only because we all know lots of people in their 60s and 70s, and even if they've had health problems, they're doing pretty well. Once people start living into their late 80s and 90s, which our generation, the boomer generation, will be in increasing numbers, significant health problems come, unless you are just one of those lucky exceptions. And the fact is that most people who die in their late 80s and 90s do not die the proverbial heart attack with no suffering preceding it while making love or skydiving or paragliding. Most people who die at those ages die after a long period of disability and suffering. That is part of what has happened with more people living to great old ages. People age successfully until they can't anymore.
Isn't this supposed to be something that isn't happening? I mean, we hear an awful lot about the centenarians. There was a composer, well-known composer, who had a 100th birthday party.
Elliot Carter.
That's right. That's right. And yet it seems that really most people I see are like my mother, who was very active. She was a modern dancer well into her early 80s and now is, you know, can barely get up out of bed.
Well, that's it. Look, the reason I call the skydiving centenarians, it would be wonderful if we were all like Elliot Carter, if we could go on being intellectually active and physically capable of walking up the steps of Carnegie Hall to accept your 100th birthday tribute. But the fact is, the reason those people receive so much publicity is that they are exceptional. They are not the norm for people who live beyond their early 90s or late 80s. My mother would be an equal example. It's not that this can't happen. We can all hope to be among those exceptions, but more typical. 5 years ago, at 85, my mother was as active an example of successful aging as you could see. She worked 25 hours as a volunteer in the critical care unit of a hospital, which is a very tough job. Now, at 90, she is basically, she like my grandmother, she has a sound mind and a ruined body. She is basically confined by a variety of age-related physical illnesses to her room in an assisted living facility. She is in constant pain because she doesn't want to take too much pain-relieving drugs because that, you know, that fuzzes your mind if you take too many of them. And my mother's situation is much more typical than that of the person who remains healthy until 100 and then drops dead.
And more of us are living to that debilitated age. Why are we living so much longer? Why can't medical care keep us from these kinds of illnesses, keep us basically healthy until the last few weeks or months of our lives?
Well, that's the dream. The reason it can't now is very simple. that your body, every part of it, the immune system which fights off infection, begins to wear out. Medical care does keep us healthy, relatively healthy in our 60s and 70s, early 70s, unless we have some terrible disease. But a good example is just a common thing, pneumonia. People used to die of pneumonia all the time at any age before there were antibiotics. Now there are better antibiotics than there were in the first generation of antibiotics. So a lot of people who might have died of pneumonia, let's say when they were 70, who were otherwise healthy when there were no antibiotics, will now survive a bout of pneumonia when they're 70. What happens when the same things happen to people in their late 80s and 90s is other parts of your body are beginning to wear out. So you don't respond as powerfully or positively or successfully to the antibiotics as you did when you were 20 years younger. Because there's a basic age limit at which everything now begins to wear out. And that makes the things that worked for people at 65 in medical treatment, they don't work as well for 85 and 95-year-olds.
I asked Susan Jacoby whether a healthy lifestyle could keep us from suffering the ravages of old age.
All right. Well, there was a lot of hope, and let me emphasize that having a healthy lifestyle, not smoking, drinking moderately, exercising, keeping mentally active, these things are all great because they keep you healthier at the age you are, whatever that age is, whether you're young, middle-aged, or old. They might even make you live a little longer, although that's not proved. And there have been a lot of articles and studies like this, so many of them, that the National Institutes of Health, this was released in August, did a meta-study of all of these studies to see whether there was any valid evidence that, for instance, you could protect yourself against Alzheimer's with exercise. All of the scientists who did this review were devastated and said so to find that there is no credible scientific evidence that these things do prevent Alzheimer's. They are good because they make you healthier when you are. They are not a magic bullet. And certainly someday it would be wonderful if there were a medication that would even delay the onset of Alzheimer's by a few years so that you would die of something else before that. But right now there isn't. I decided to write this book when I went to a panel in which there was a lot of talk about Alzheimer's, but the magic pill. It was titled 90 is the New 50. And there was one voice of rationality on that panel, which was the late Dr. Robert N. Butler, who died at 82 of leukemia last year, who is a friend of mine, who virtually invented the field of gerontology. And I asked him after this panel, I said, you know, what do you think about the imminence of a cure for Alzheimer's? And he said, look, nobody believes in science more than I do. I've been a scientist my whole life. But he said, realistically, the state of the scientific research is that there is going to come something to treat this, just as we now have drugs that can treat the progression of multiple sclerosis to some extent. But he said, that's going to come along for our children or maybe our grandchildren. It's not going to be there in the state of the science for people in their late 50s and 60s. Now, if it does, he said, then hallelujah, we'll have solved one of the biggest problems of old age. But he said, counting on that breakthrough just in time for you is not a strategy for dealing with what it looks like old age is still going to be.
And we're talking with Susan Jacoby. Her latest book is Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. A lot of us, in fact, are going to face that. I mean, you give a horrifying statistic in the book that for people who survive to over 85, they have a 50% chance in any particular year of developing Alzheimer's.
50% of people over 85 have dementia, of which Alzheimer's is the leading cause. 50% of people who live beyond 85 have a chance of spending some months or years in a nursing home before they die, which correlates almost exactly with the rate of dementia. You can cope, if you've got your mind, with almost any non-mind problem to some degree, but once you've lost your mind, you need custodial care.
And so what do we have to look forward to? I mean, we are here in a time where it seems that the deficit-cutting fever is really threatening. It seems that it's cut, cut, cut.
Well, there's a basic problem here right now. Part of this talk about cutting Social Security and Medicare as if that were easy is based on people who really don't understand the needs of old age. If it were true that 90 were the new 50, and that everybody was able of taking care of themselves and, by the way, of saving enough money for a 30-year retirement, then we don't have to do anything because, well, it's a new old age. The old are well able to take care of themselves. But the fact is there's a cannonball coming at us, and it's us, you and me, which is to say that these 65-year-old baby boomers having their birthdays this year who are being applauded to the tune of Forever Young are going to be 85 20 years from now. There are several things that have to be done, and one of them has to be, it sounds crazy because we're in an age right now of unreason in which people talk about raising the retirement age as if everyone could work until they're 70. Many people can, but many people can't. People whose lives have been hard physical labor, their bodies are shot before then. There is something we can do about Medicare, for example. One of the things that we can do about Medicare, there's no way we're going to finance our old age as a society, and it's a social as well as an individual responsibility, without raising taxes, without having means testing. But having the idea that you can fix Medicare by having millionaires not get Medicare benefits, you can't because there aren't that many millionaires around. And the other thing is people get poorer and unhealthier as they get older. Everybody's going to have to pay higher taxes. Everybody's going to have to pay Social Security and Medicare taxes on all of their income, not just with an income ceiling limit. And here's something the old have got to understand, that young people, of whom there are fewer young workers, are not going to pay for our Medicare and Social Security willingly unless we address the problem of what the young have to pay for health care now. Health care, when I was in my 20s and 30s, cost almost nothing. You got benefits with the job you had. It didn't cost you anything. I didn't resent what I paid for Social Security for 1 minute. That was for my granny. But when young people have to pay 15% of their after-tax income, as I did for bad health insurance before I turned 65, there is going to be intergenerational warfare unless we fix this. There's no solution to the problem of taking care of the old without a more rational health care system for the young. There's no solution to that for the young without taking care of the old. So far, nobody in either party is ready to face either the financial or the human facts about it. That jerk, retired Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming, who was the chairman of the Federal Deficit Commission, described Social Security as a cow with 310 million tits. How is that for a metaphor? And by the way, it's not incidental that the vast majority of the old are women, who are poorer than men in old age and get poorer with every year they live.
So really what you're saying here is that the solution is Medicare for all.
I think that is the solution, but it has to be Medicare with government controls on costs greater. The passage, one of the great things that's driven up the deficit is the passage of the prescription drug bill for seniors. And what's wrong with it is not that they're providing care for seniors with prescription drugs. It's that they didn't impose government cost controls on big pharma. These drugs that our old people are taking cost 2 to 3 to 4 times as much as they do in any other country in the developed world, where the government says to the pharmaceutical companies, we're going to pay you this, we're your biggest customer, and that's that. And you know what? The pharmaceutical companies in Europe are making plenty of money, too. You cannot have any kind of universal health benefit without government-imposed cost controls. There's something else that needs to be done. Right now, a huge proportion of the Medicare benefit is spent not in the last year of life alone, but in the last month of life. And only 30% of Americans have living wills and have appointed someone to follow their wishes legally, like my mother has, for instance. My mother does not want to be kept alive by artificial means, which is where the big health care bill the last month of life comes up, if there is no hope of her recovery. And my brother and I have the legal power to act for, should she not be able to act for herself. If only some of the 70% of Americans who haven't made any arrangements of this kind did it, it would greatly cut the Medicare budget. So what do? Scared to death by the far right, Obama withdraws a proposal which would have paid for just voluntary consultations every few years between patients and their doctors about what their wishes for end-of-life care are. 90% of Americans say they want to die at home. Only 20% do, because what happens when people haven't written their wishes down is they get sent to the hospital where the default position is do everything, even if what they're doing is prolonging dying instead of prolonging life.
Right, and those very people who forced Obama or pushed Obama to do that, the ones who were screaming about the death panel, seem to be the same ones who were talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare.
Of course they are. None of these things add up. That's my point, is there are things we can do for rationality that don't involve more government control. Just encouraging people to think about this, to understand that these things will be done to them whether they want it or not, unless they write down their wishes. And the best time to do this is not when people are sick and very old, but when they're in their relatively healthy 60s and 70s. The best time to find somebody to act for you if you can't act for yourself is then. And people can't necessarily assume their own child is the best person either. Your child may not share your values. My mom, who worked as a volunteer in the critical care unit dealing with families in this situation, was her big thing. And she said most of the time people hadn't even talked to their children. People actually threw things at each other in the waiting room of the critical care unit. Children disagreed. This is something that people can control, how much aggressive care they want at the very end of life, which people have to talk to their relatives and talk to their doctors, who, by the way, aren't any less reluctant to deal with this than anybody who's not a doctor. And for those who have thoughts and wishes on this, to make them known legally would make a big hole in the end-of-life care budget. And in other words, you have to have people deciding, do I want to be kept alive on a ventilator? Do I want to be artificially fed with a tube if I'm never going to wake up? Well, my mother took care of all that 20 years ago. My brother and I don't have to worry about what she wants done if she can't act, because she's told us.
And now, Susan Jacoby, you also talk in the book Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. You talk about the problem that we face even more acutely now since the crash of 2007-2008 of us outliving our savings.
Well, that's a serious problem. And particularly for the older boomers, the people in their late 50s and early 60s who don't have as much time as the younger boomers to recover from the crash of 2008. But a lot of the talk about this assumed that most boomers were well set before then. But that's not true either. In fact, the average amount of people with 401ks, which are people who are fortunate enough to be employed by people who contribute to 401ks, was $45,000 before the crash. Now it's about half of that. But $45,000 isn't enough for a 30-year retirement. And I should say there has been a lot of boomer bashing, and everybody is sick of us, as I've been told at talks by both younger and older people. But the assumption that the average person on an average salary is capable of saving enough money for a 30-year retirement is highly dubious. When Social Security Act was signed in 1935, the average life expectancy was 62. And people then were not able to save enough for retirement. That's why Social Security was passed. But now, when we are talking about 20 years from now, there are going to be 8.5 million people over 85. A lot of us are not going to have the money to retire on. And it's not just people's fault. Look, the median income for an ordinary family of four is about $61,000 in this country. When you think about the cost of college tuition, the cost of health insurance right now for younger people, how are people going to save enough for a 30-year retirement? I just laugh when I hear these people on television shows who are making $1 million a year as anchors talk about how we've all got to save more personally. Let's talk about a 50-year-old couple or a 45-year-old couple. They've got a child in college. Do we want one society where mom and dad in their late 40s turn to their kid and say, sorry, we can't help you with your college education. We've got to save for our long-term care. Is that the kind of society we want? Because a lot of people don't have enough money to do both. I'd vote with people ought to help the next generation. The next generation ought to help us when we need it.
Well, Susan Jacoby, your excellent book is Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age. Thanks so much for talking with us here on this very, very important issue.
Thank you. And don't shoot the messenger.
Never Say Die is Susan Jacoby's 10th nonfiction book. Her most recent books include the New York Times bestseller, The Age of American Unreason, out in 2008, and Alger Hiss and the Battle for History, out in 2009. Next up, we talk about an innovative and commonsensical approach to taking care of our elders. It's cost-effective and humane. You can go to Writer's Voice to listen to or download past shows and find out a lot more about our guests. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word, or visit our Facebook page. Most of us expect to die at home, surrounded by friends and family. But as we heard earlier, most of us won't. We'll die in a hospital after months or years, warehoused in a nursing home. But not if Dr. Alan Teal has his way. He's practiced geriatric and family medicine in Damariscotta, Maine, for 25 years. He cares deeply about his patients, and he respects them. So he chafed at the isolation, helplessness, and uselessness so many seniors experience in today's nursing homes. His frustration led him to develop a different approach, one that uses grassroots community action and 21st century technologies to empower elders to stay in their homes and lead healthier, happier lives. He started out by calling it the Maine approach, but he wants to roll it out across the country and is now calling it Full Circle America. That's why he wrote the book Alone and Invisible No More. It's out from Chelsea Green. To begin my interview with Dr. Teal, I started out by asking him to talk about the dimensions of the crisis that's facing elders now and the rest of us in the future.
The demographics are things that we've never faced before. 100 years ago, there were only 3 million Americans that were over age 65. Now there are 35 million, and within 20 years, it'll be 85 million. That's astounding in and of itself, but I think the demographics of those older individuals within the cohort are even more startling. Those over 85 years old are quintupling from 4 million to 21 million. And even the Americans over age 100 are projected by 2050 to number 1 million Americans. So this demands an entire new way of thinking. And as things now stand, most people over 85 at some point or another end up in a residential care facility. And so the economics are equally unsustainable. If you think about it and you've had the sticker shock of going out and looking at what available options cost, and if it's $5,000 a month for an assisted living facility, which in the Northeast it's approaching $6,000 or $6,500 in a lot of places, or a nursing home is approaching $10,000 a month, or if you want to stay in your own home and can find private duty care at $15 or $20 an hour, that's going to tally close to $150,000 to $200,000 a year, or $15,000+ a month for staying in your own home. So clearly, nobody can afford this for very long. Most people run out of their lifetime savings in 6 to 12 months, and then they're on state assistance. So no state or federal government, no private individuals, no companies can afford the current costs. So we have ridiculous costs, and just as importantly, we have a totally unacceptable quality of life. None of us would willingly trade places with most of the situations we find our elder citizens faced with.
We're talking with Dr. Alan Teal. He's a geriatrician who's developed a new approach to caring for the elderly, one that enables even seniors who have been living in nursing homes to go back to living at home. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. Stay tuned for more after the break.
But now the days grow short. I'm in the autumn of the year, and now I think of my life as vintage wine from fine old kegs, from the brim to the dregs, and it poured sweet and clear. It was a very good year.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Dr. Alan Teal about a new approach to elder care he's pioneering. His book is Alone and Invisible No More. Teal's work came out of his frustration with the conditions he found working with the elderly in nursing homes and assisted living. Could you describe some of those conditions that you found?
You know, they're not despicable. You know, the places are usually neat and clean. The real issue is that elders regularly complain about how long the days are, and what they yearn for are more human connections. And mostly what we've been guilty of in the healthcare field and is that we focus far too much on the medical side of the equation. A reasonable facility is one that gives you your medications on time, that responds rather promptly to a fall, that records your bowel and bladder function fine, and seeks medical attention for you when you need it. But I think most of us would readily agree that that isn't an acceptable quality of life, that we have to have way more to have a reason to get up in the morning. And those reasons that we want to get up in the morning usually have to do with human connections, connections to people, pets, sometimes family, sometimes friends, sometimes community interests. And we long for those connections that sustained us during our working years, during our raising our children, during the years when maybe when we were recently retired and we could be quite busy in the community, and all of a sudden we're pretty isolated and nobody really knows what happened to us and we don't really exist in a full sense of the word. We in the healthcare field give some reasonable lip service to holistic care, but we're really not focusing on the whole individual. And I'm not trying to discount how important a role the medical field plays if you have a condition that really impairs your ability to function. But they are very much dwarfed by the need for human connections, and those things are sadly lacking most of the time in far too many good places. We just have it wrong in terms of the focus, and we all hide behind the fact that, well, there's liability and there's cost. And I think, you know, we can't get into a discussion of this without talking about liability. And I have a chapter in the book called The Dignity of Risk. It's a phrase that I borrowed from the community that works with the developmentally disabled. And in the 70s, when we were, as a society, trying to find ways to deinstitutionalize the, quote, mentally retarded at those point and get them back into community, there was a big debate about risk and how could we handle that. The dignity of risk is that we have to allow individuals the opportunity to succeed or fail. And if we don't allow them to have that option to fail, then we're depriving them of the opportunity to grow. And that really hit me real hard, because at what age are we supposed to stop growing?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important that we really look at our parents, our aunts and uncles, our neighbors, very much differently than we have so far. You know, and when we're looking at them with this different viewpoint, you know, it is really about what are their goals and aspirations. When was the last time many 80 and 90-year-olds were asked what do they want to do with the rest of their lives? Maybe it's something simple. You know, I just want to see my grandkids more often. I had one really curmudgeon-y older woman who the family was throwing up their hands at, and she had fired every single person that had come across her path from caregivers. And when I finally worked and worked and worked over about an hour to find out what made her tick, she finally got it and a light bulb went on, and she said, I'd really like to be down in that field behind the house and smell the spring flowers again. Mm. It really knocked me over. And I said, yeah, we can do that.
Talk about what you did do before you started this Maine approach. I mean, it sounds like you created a really wonderful number of residences, all of them mm-hmm. kind of connected mm-hmm. and focused on quality of life, not just the medical care. And yet you feel that that model has failed as well.
Sure. It should be a part of the landscape. What you're referring to are a number of assisted living homes called the Elder Care Network that a couple of colleagues and I co-founded about 15 years ago. And our goal was to try to produce home-like assisted living in small residential care facilities that would have 6 or 8 residents in them. So they would create their own kind of small nuclear living unit. And they would all be centrally administered, and that there would be an attempt to try to focus more completely on the whole person. Our goals were pretty noble, and we've done a pretty good job, but you run into interference from everywhere else. We were primarily focusing on the low-income elderly, and so that meant folks that were on state assistance, and state assistance meant that they came with all of the regulations that state assistance entails. And the assisted living world tries to address a very broad range of needs from people that are just one step shy of a nursing home to people that require just a tiny bit of extra help to live pretty independently. So it is a very broad gamut of people that make up the assisted living population, and no doubt that taxes a lot of regulatory folks and agencies to try to deal with. But within that, the medical model has created this approach to nursing home care, and it has moved that nursing home model into regulating assisted living more and more over the last 15 years.
We're talking with Dr. Alan Teal about his book, Alone and Invisible No More. It's about a new approach he's developed to elder care that helps seniors, even frail seniors, stay in their homes. That group of homes faced an $8,000 fine. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, truly shocked when I read this. It seemed to be such an unreasonable situation. Maybe just in brief, you know, sketch out what happened and what the state was demanding from you.
Well, even though most assisted living facilities, in order to try to make things more home-like and more affordable, the folks that are doing the lion's share of the staff work are folks maybe with a high school education, maybe with a little more. They have taken a personal care attendant course or a nurse's aide course. So they have a little bit of medical knowledge. They have a big heart. But then they are supposed to chart on these older individuals that are under their care, commenting on whether they have hallucinations, whether they have all of the symptoms of major depression. And the scoring system that the state uses to try to get a handle on what level of care they want to reimburse at, because everything now is graded and coded according to how much care you need, then they do 2- and 4-week look-back periods in which they pick an isolated chunk of time, and within that 7-day period of time, for instance, they want to find 2 or 3 notations that that individual was hallucinating, and they want it in the notes. And if it doesn't exist in the notes, it doesn't exist. And so because the individuals that we were taking care of and for whom we were fined, they could find two notations in 7 days when they wanted three, or they could find three notations in 28 days when they wanted four. That was considered a chart that was in error, and that the coding for that was insufficient to support the diagnosis of that mental health condition. And they reviewed six individuals' charts, decided that three of them, in the 400 different questions that they asked, had an error somewhere in those 400 questions. And based on one error in 400 questions on that individual, the whole chart was considered to have been wrongly coded, and three errors in three charts gave you a 60% error rate and set you up for this fine of $8,000 to $10,000 for that whole period, because they now take that as representative of the care administered in that home, and they fine you 10% of the entire state payment to that home over the previous 3 to 6 months.
And it was like almost that you were on trial.
Absolutely. When I challenged it as the chairman of the board and said, somebody's got to speak up on this. And after 2 years later, we finally got to have an administrative hearing. And when we sat down for the administrative hearing, the hearing officer introduced me to the rules of the proceedings, that both sides, my side and the state, would be able to call witnesses, that we would be able to cross-examine each other's witnesses, that there would be opening and closing arguments. And I looked across the table, and the person who was representing the state was the Assistant Attorney General. And so here we were, a small residential care assisted living home, and we were literally on trial for defending our actions around these frail 90-year-old individuals. We were not trying to say that the documentation was better than it was. We were saying the rules themselves don't make any sense, and the severity of the penalty doesn't make any sense. To threaten the financial survival of a home that had been applauded by many other state agencies over these picayune details wasn't logical.
Yeah. And is that typical, would you say?
It is absolutely typical. It's the way every single home is graded. And actually, as states get into more difficult budget crises, they are looking for ways to recoup their costs. Mm-hmm. They are seeing this as a way to balance their budgets better by getting some of the money back. So this is going to become more and more of an issue as more and more state governments are faced with the difficulties of trying to pay for residential care.
You know, I know your book isn't, you know, came up before this happened, but I just have to ask you, we are hearing now that Obama and the Republicans are kind of getting together on slashing Social Security and Medicare. What kind of effect do you think that that might have on nursing homes like the ones that you helped to start? Assisted living facility.
Right. Well, clearly the money that is spent in the residential care world is a large piece of the Medicare budget. You know, there are states where something like 50% of the Medicaid dollars that are allocated to that state are spent for residential care. There are numbers that say that the nursing home industry right now is a $100 billion a year industry. Now, we're talking about very large numbers. If we continue to do what we're doing in terms of the utilization rate of residential care facilities for older individuals, over the next 20 years, most small communities of 50,000 people will need to build 3 more nursing homes and 8 or 10 more assisted living facilities in their communities. The cost of building these in each of these small communities is going to approach $100 million to build these facilities, and then $50 million a year to run them. That translates to $5,000 worth of new costs for every single household in every single community.
Wow.
$5,000 a year.
For every one of us.
For every household in every community for business as usual.
And so you have this model that you've developed, the main approach that you say can provide better care at a lesser cost. Tell us what that is.
Well, what we're trying to do is employ a new attitude, as I've talked to you about, you know, where we focus on what are the goals and aspirations, but we're also trying to tap into this enormous talent pool of elders. And that is to say, no matter what your age, what do you still have left in the tank? What is it that you can still do that is of value to somebody else around you? And how do we parcel out the jobs that need doing, the tasks that need doing, to the entire cohort of people in our community, the entire elders and the rest of the age groups in our community? If most of what we're lacking is connections to people, and most older individuals are feeling lonely and isolated, well, how do we get people together more? For instance, we had an older individual who lived in one of our assisted living facilities with mild dementia, who was a childhood friend of a lady whose family was providing around-the-clock care for her moderate dementia in her own home. We had the very simple idea of putting them together a couple of afternoons a week under the care of the woman with mild dementia in the residential care facility. They watched each other and laughed and joked like schoolgirls. They needed no supervision for those two afternoons. They handled everything perfectly fine within a minimally supervised setting. Mm-hmm. So the goal was, no matter how frail somebody might be physically or mentally, what are the things they can do? If you told me, you know, several years ago that you could take folks with significant mental and physical impairments and move them on the spur of the moment into somebody else's space and get away with it, my medical side would have said, no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. But it really worked surprisingly well. So we've tried to replicate that.
Let me ask you a question, because I read all this in your book, Dr. Alan Teal, and the book is Alone and Invisible No More, How Grassroots Community Action and 21st Century Technologies Can Empower Elders to Stay in Their Homes and Lead Healthier, Happier Lives. I read it very much with my mom in mind. You know, we're thinking of bringing her back home. But the question that I had, you know, she's lively of mind, but she has become quite immobile. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid to have her live alone, even with motion sensors. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about how you use the technology, and could she really live alone?
Well, it gets back to what is a reasonable amount of risk to take for what kind of quality of life. You know, and I'm not saying that you move her into an apartment and then, you know, nobody checks in on her. What we're really trying to do is individualize every single situation as much as possible. And that being said, I admit an awful lot more patients to the hospital with broken hips and broken bones that they've suffered at the residential care facilities than I have in their own homes.
Wow.
People fall down, you know, and sometimes you get hurt and sometimes you don't. And that being said, it requires a great deal of attention to detail to try to figure out what kind of risk the individual really has. Many folks, if you watch them on these webcams that we're using, they do furniture walk, they do move cautiously, and fortunately, most of these individuals, they've gotten used to navigating in their own space quite safely. And actually, they get into more trouble when you move them to an unfamiliar space than if you try to provide some assistance for them in their own space. But let's take worst-case scenario. How do you handle somebody within their own space? And we have physical therapists that also watch somebody walk and say, oh, my goodness, how could you possibly let this person? They might fall.
Mm-hmm.
And they have made us all really frightened of our own shadows at times. I look at my dad walking, and he throws his hips from one side to the other and looks very awkward in his gait. But he hasn't fallen down in his house ever. So what we've done is try to learn what the trouble spots are in folks' lives by the motion sensors and the webcams and our direct observation. But we're starting from a different vantage point, and that is, as I mentioned earlier, what are your goals and aspirations? And if that individual says, I wouldn't want to live if you moved me to a residential care facility, you would extinguish all desire of mine to live at all if you did that. Well, then we better start from that starting point and try to figure out a way to make something work. And if we do, what does that model look like? Well, we put webcams in the common spaces, and if somebody is really frail, we even put webcams in a bedroom. But we tend to angle it to the places where they're going to fall, the space between the bed and the bathroom, right, not necessarily on the bed. And yet, with strategically placed webcams that are motion-driven so that they take snapshots, we can then spot check these. We can actually watch live video. These spot checks are available to family members as well as anyone else that that individual gives us permission to share it with. So usually it's doctors and nurses and family.
And how much does something like this cost? I mean, you're talking about maybe somebody having personal care coming in, you know, a couple of hours a day. You're saying that this is less costly.
Sure. Well, we're able to do all of the technology and the monitoring and all of the coordination of volunteers, the coordination of family members, the coordination of caregivers, and we've been able to do that whole tech, provide all of the technology, maintain the technology, install the technology, and pay attention to all of the remote monitoring with it for about $400 a month. And so if you take $400 a month and add to it whatever personal care somebody needs, we've been able to find that even folks that were qualified by the conventional scoring as needing nursing home level of care, they can survive quite nicely in their home, much happier, with 1 or 2 hours a day of personal care and 22 or 23 hours a day of remote monitoring. And that you got to break up that time. So if you are paying for an hour of care, a lot of folks need a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour at night. Mm-hmm. Most of the nursing homes and other services, for their own financial constraints, make you have 2 or 3 hour minimums.
Right.
And so we're trying to break that mold, and we're trying to say, what is it you really need? And some of it you need a paid staff person for, and sometimes you just need a volunteer or neighbor to spot check you. The person who brings the newspaper to your door, they can really tell somebody whether you're on the floor or not.
Right.
There are a lot of things you don't need a trained medical person to do. A lot of times you need somebody to heat up a microwave meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that isn't something you need a medical degree for. You know, there are a whole lot of those personal touches that if we can combine those with an hour or so of paid staff care, you know, look at it the other way around. If you had to pay for 24-hour care and you can cut that down to 12 hours a day, you've reduced the cost by half.
Right.
If you can break it down to 6 hours a day, you've reduced it by three quarters. If you can get it down to an hour or two a day, you've reduced the cost by 90-95% for the labor charges. You know, so we're not able to find people that will work for less, and as a matter of fact, we're not trying to. We're actually trying to say that the folks that do this noble work should be paid reasonably well. So we're trying to get away from also the current paradigm where many of these individuals that do the lion's share of the heavy lifting literally are paid minimum wage or only a little bit more than that. And we feel that they should be reasonably paid.
But yet not needed as much.
But not needed as much. Mm-hmm. And we can actually stretch out the kind of care that these folks can do so that we get more good people doing more work for more people. and the cost per person is an awful lot less if we spread it out this way.
So you actually have a system where you find people who are willing to work under this kind of personal care model where they may spend an hour or two with somebody, and then maybe they go to somebody else in the system? Mm-hmm. Is that how that works?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. And so they get to know a small number of people very, very well. And these folks become part of their family, as they do in many home care agencies. These folks work very, very hard and are very dedicated to the folks they take care of. But rather than pay somebody 6 or 8 or 10 hours worth of time to sleep or sit or watch or do something, we try to target the care to the trigger points or the difficult times for some people's lives. And sometimes, you know, a lot of times it's when you get up and when you go to bed, the beginning and end of the day. But the beginning and end of the day for you might be 6 a.m. and for me it might be 10 a.m., you know, or vice versa. We're literally trying to put it together, a weekly planner, around the wishes of that individual and find out where the holes are and fill in the holes, partly with closer monitoring at sometimes and partly with visitors or spot checkers or... And the whole thing is to turn the paradigm around a little bit and say, okay, Mrs. Jones has a nicely tuned piano in her room, in her house, and there's somebody in town who really needs a place to practice where they won't bother anybody. Okay, can we link up those folks? And this lady that I'm just referring to is a lady with moderate dementia whose family... ran out of money trying to provide 24/7 care for her with a live-in staff. And a couple years ago, they found us, and we've been providing her care for about $700 or $800 a month rather than the $15,000 or $20,000 a month they were paying before.
That's amazing.
And so we've saved that family several hundred thousand dollars. And this woman is ambulatory. She's profoundly forgetful, but she's ambulatory, and she loves music. And anybody that will come in and play any semblance of a song really excites her.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Alan Teal, I'm so excited to have you talk with us here on Writer's Voice about your book, Alone and Invisible No More. I found it a fascinating read, probably because I'm facing that situation with my mother, but we're all facing the same situation. I know for those of us who are baby boomers, you know, I'm terrified about what's coming down the pike. I don't want the system as it is to be the one that tries to take care of me.
You know, this is the elephant in the living room, as so many problems are, where you can't go to a meeting at any office. You know, walk up to any cooler anywhere, and you'll find somebody right next to you who's dealing with this kind of a situation with their own family. You know, this is an epidemic that we're all having to deal with, and we're trying to run our own lives, and none of us are very happy with the choices. So what we're trying to say is, let's start working together right now to develop these choices. It's actually really quite simple. A little bit of technology, a little bit of good old-fashioned neighborliness, a little bit of common sense, and a little bit of medical care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and can we put those ingredients together to make a far more affordable model and a far more engaging and humane model than what we have right now?
Oh, that's great. Well, thanks again.
Well, thank you very much.
Dr. Alan Teal. You can find a link to the Full Circle America website dedicated to his approach at writersvoice.net. You'll also find a web-only extra where Dr. Teal tells a great story about his own elderly father, who took care of an even more frail elder when the man's daughter needed a respite. It's a great example of the Full Circle America approach. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.